This is Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
A window to the Latin universe.
Stanford 90.1 FM.
Radio Atenea Americana.
This is
Atenea Americana.
Bilingual house of culture on the air and online.
Radio
Atenea Americana.
Su casa de la cultura en la radio y online.
Para la radio 90.1 KCSU Stanford.
I am Isabel Jubes.
Isabel Jubes. Bienvenidos.
Atenea Americana.
Welcome. Bienvenidos.
From Stanford to the world.
Since the beginning of time, humankind has been on the search of knowledge, trying to find answers to questions, exploring the outer limits and dreaming about what else is there. In the last century, we have developed new technologies that got us to a new race, the race for space exploration. For this new quest, we have built amazing Earth telescopes. We have sent technologies to explore for us the skies, like the Hubble telescope or the Kepler mission, among others. But with every day new technological developments and new discoveries, we can now move even further with less resources and with less efforts. This is the case of the project that Chilean engineer Dr. Eduardo Bendek is working for NASA Ames in Mountain View, California. He is here to talk to us about the new telescope he is developing to allow for the search of new Earth-like exoplanets that could be reachable for humankind in a reasonable amount of time. His telescopes are designed to be a more economical and viable technology with the only purpose to locate these planets and even make more accurate maps of the areas in question. So today in Atenea Americana with Dr. Eduardo Bendek from NASA Ames. Today we have another show about space and space exploration, and for that today our guest, scientist from Ames, NASA, his name is Eduardo Bendek, and he is originally from Chile, and he has been researching and exploring for other exoplanets and for planets that could actually allow some life in them. Thank you for coming here, and thank you for being part of Atenea Americana.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
So you're from Chile. How did you get here? How was your path towards the space exploration and all this science?
So I was born in Chile, in Santiago, and I have been always very interested in engineering, technology, and astronomy at the same time. So since I was a kid, I was always looking in the space and the sky with my small telescope and learning about physics. So I started my degree in engineering and I minor in astrophysics. And after that, I joined a big observatory that is in the Atacama Desert, which is called the Very Large Telescope. Mm-hmm. That observatory belongs to the European Union. And over there, I serve as an instrumentation engineer, taking care of the instruments and making them ready for the night and preparing the telescopes for the night. So every day I'll do engineering and maintenance and adjusting the system to be on the best performance for the night. Working 5 years in the desert doing that bring me so close to the science and to the top level engineering that I was really encouraged to keep forward and doing my PhD on optics and learning how to design all these amazing machines and telescopes. So then I quit my job over there and I moved here to pursue a PhD in optics. I finished my degree in optics, and my research was very well connected to what NASA needed at that point, NASA AIM. So I applied for the postdoctoral program, NASA postdoctoral program, and I got accepted. So I moved here to NASA Ames, and I did my postdoc, mostly doing research on new technologies for exoplanets. My postdoc ended in September, and now I'm a staff at NASA Ames, and my role is to develop new technologies to be able to observe planets like the Earth around other stars. That's what we call exoplanets. Mm-hmm. So that's a summary of my path to where I am now.
So like in Star Trek, they will call planets type M or...
So a very good analogy for what we're doing is the movie Interstellar. So on the movie Interstellar, there is this quest for an Earth-like planet, a planet that can sustain life so we can immigrate there. Now, on that movie, they conceived that this planet's going to be very, very far. Therefore, you have to use this wormhole in order to travel there. Now, our research is focused on nearby stars. In fact, our mission proposal that we just proposed to NASA last year is focused on investigating the possibility of finding a planet like the Earth around Alpha Centauri, which is our closest star. It's only 4 light years away. So we're focusing on stars that actually, in a long term, we may be able to travel there, even without wormholes, just with on our own means. So that's the focus of my research.
So how far is it again?
4 light years. So 4 light years is... the distance that takes a light
to get there.
To get there in 4 years. However, this distance is enormous. However, if you conceive that we invest enough money and time into space propulsion, it's conceivable to get there in a time scale of 40, 50, 100 years. So it's very hard and very far, but it's not impossible.
Yeah, so, and we have to start sometime.
Exactly. And our role on this is to address the question, or to answer the question, is there a planet that can sustain life in that star? If there is a planet, then that allows policymakers to shift the proper resources to explore further. But if we are not able to answer the question, if there is a planet that is worth traveling there, then there doesn't make any sense to invest money on going there.
Yeah, and those will be better options than moving to other moons or planets in our solar systems then, because they will already have probably oxygen or water.
So our goal is to find what we call habitable planet. A habitable planet is a planet that is at the right distance to a star, so it's not too cold or not too hot, so the water can be liquid, and also it has an atmosphere that contains oxygen. So our instrument, our space telescope, will be able to assess if that planet has all those characteristics to be able to host life. So Mars or Venus or Mercury, they don't have those characteristics. So it's harder to live over there. So to establish a colony in Mars will require a lot of auxiliary equipment. You cannot breathe on the... There is almost no atmosphere, and the atmosphere that is there is not appropriate for humans. So we're looking for a planet that will resemble what the life that we have here on Earth, a place that where you can just go out and breathe.
Yeah, without having to change the environment, just going there and arrive.
Exactly.
One of the research that, and the part that you're proposing, says that with not that such a big telescope, you can actually modify and find those planets without having a huge equipment, in difference to what we actually believe that we need to actually see and qualify the planets.
So that is exactly our value proposition to NASA, is that we believe that the technology that we're working on is capable on accessing those planetary systems without a large telescope. And the question that the public may bring to the table is, okay, why this hasn't been done before if it's possible to do it with a small telescope? What is the new technology or the new capability that you're bringing to the table that allow you to do that? The answer goes in three aspects. One is on statistics. The Kepler mission, that is also a NASA mission, that has allowed us to understand that there is a large number of stars that has Earth-like planets. So that is a complete change of paradigm, because before we didn't have that statistics, that those that evidence, statistical evidence, that there is a high chance of having an Earth-like planet around nearby star, like Alpha Centauri. So therefore, people discarded that system as an option. Now we know that there is a high probability of finding a planet there, so we are able to look at this very close star. Second, we develop a very special technology that allows you to use small telescopes to be able to have high resolution, so you don't need anymore that very large telescope. And the third reason is that most of space telescopes, they try to serve several purposes. For example, Hubble, it serves several astrophysical goals. Therefore, it's difficult to optimize the telescope to do something in particular. Mm-hmm. Our approach is different, is to go and say, okay, let's design this telescope just to find a planet around Alpha Centauri. So it's very specific. The telescope cannot do anything else. However, it's the best on doing that. That allows you to make the telescope smaller, lighter, and lower cost, because you, everything that you do, every decision that you take, is just focused on that.
And remember that today in Atenea Americana, we are talking with Chilean engineer Dr. Eduardo Bendek from NASA Ames in California.
So the Hubble has been on the space for many years.
25 years.
Yeah, this technology has changed a lot, so the capabilities that it will have are very smaller than whatever we build today. Even a cell phone can be can have more memory and more capabilities technologically. So that will be something that you could send out of our atmosphere for better resolution and look outside, because I understand that whatever we see from inside the Earth is not as clear because of our atmosphere.
That is correct. We need to launch to space to go beyond the atmosphere. If you are on the ground, you have this twinkling effect of the stars. And if you have been like in the beach on a summer day and then you look lights far away, you see that they twinkle and they move, they disappear. Mm-hmm. That's the distortion of created by bubbles in the atmosphere, hot air bubbles that revolve the atmosphere. So when you're trying to find something so small like a planet next to a very bright star, what happens is that destroys your signal. So you need to go on the space to remove all that perturbations of the atmosphere and be able to observe the planet. That's the reason that a space mission is justified in this case. Mm-hmm. And not even if you have the largest ground-based telescope, you won't be able to see the planet because of the distortion created by the atmosphere.
And today you can see that they are sending these very, very small satellites, for example, outside. And even at the Tech Museum, the kids can see that this little cube that they send, and it's actually, it can go around the Earth and have a lot of data, and which is, I think, actually an iPhone inside. So it will be like a big telescope, or it will be like a little thing that you will send and it will go, like Hubble, that will go forever.
So that's a very interesting question. And the challenge that we have ahead of developing this space mission that will be able to take the first image of a planet like the Earth is really, really big. It's difficult to do that. It's technologically very demanding to get to the precision level that we need. To tackle that problem, we have proposed two different space missions. One, which is going to be based on these small or CubeSats, that is what you're mentioning, because they allow you to get access to space faster and for less cost, for lower cost. So we're proposing a space mission on a CubeSat that is called Centaur. it's called Centaur because of the constellation Alpha Centauri. Mm-hmm. The star is called Alpha Centauri, and the constellation is called Centaurus. Mm-hmm. So Centaur is this mission that will be able to test the technology. So it's kind of the precursor. Mm-hmm. It's going to have less capabilities, but it will test all these new devices that had never flown in space, that we test them and they work in the lab, but mm-hmm. it's very important to fly them on space for a very low cost and in a rapid development pace. And in parallel, we're proposing this larger, fully capable mission that will be able to take the images of space, but that is a longer term. That is scheduled to fly on 2020. Mm-hmm. And for a lot more money. So that's a way that we are planning or strategizing our development to be able to do the best or most efficient uses of resources.
Do you use at all ISS, the International Space Station, for do some tests, and or is just too close to Earth to actually be able to say something?
Actually, the International Space Station is an excellent opportunity mm-hmm. for this research. One of our options is to, for this small prototype called Centaur, is to bring it to the International Space Station. And we are now making the trade studies to understand whether it's better to do a standalone flyer on low Earth orbit mm-hmm. or going to International Space Station, which is also in low Earth orbit. But the International Space Station also has a heat load and perturbation vibrations that are difficult for us. So we're mm-hmm. in the process of assessing what is the best alternative. And, mm-hmm. but absolutely, there are many things that can be done at the International Space Station.
So do you think that one of these missions, even though they are going to be far away, but they're going to be, if we actually find something with air and probably even water, it will be cheaper and more viable than changing Mars or the environment of Mars or Titan or Europe to actually go there and leave? It will be better to just go far away?
I'm not the right person to answer that question. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of uncertainty on what is the best strategy. The only thing that I can tell you is my dream, my job, and my responsibility mm-hmm. is to be able to answer the mm-hmm. question, if there are a planet with the characteristic that we need to live or not. Mm-hmm. So after we're able to answer that question, yeah. then other specialists, other scientists that know the topic of developing life and sustaining life, mm-hmm. they probably are the ones called to answer the question of what is the best strategy or mm-hmm. whether if it's a good strategy or not. Mm-hmm. So from my point of view, I see my job as making a map, mm-hmm. as making a map to where we can go and what is out there. Mm-hmm. But then the decision afterwards are too far ahead and it's not the time to make it. A good analogy for this is what Columbus did. Mm-hmm. So Columbus embarked on a trip where most of the people thought that there was a waterfall at the end of the world and mm-hmm. he will die. This is a lot more conservative. We're just trying to understand the map. We're just trying to understand what is out there mm-hmm. with a remote telescope that we'll be able to look. Mm-hmm. And if we're able to make that map, then everything will be much easier.
Yeah, Columbus, even they did have some maps, but they were very fussy and they end up not being right. So he just launched and made his own map. But you're actually going to give the map before we get there.
Exactly. So imagine if Columbus would have a nice mm-hmm. map where mm-hmm. he knew exactly where to go. His mm-hmm. expedition would have been much easier.
So that will also mean that if you send a message, a light speed is a digital message. Can you send a light speed? Mm-hmm. Whatever is happening there, you're going to say, hey, how are you doing? It's going to take 4 years, and then I'm doing fine. Come back, and you're going to have the reply 8 years after that. So we will have to, one of the goals will be also to step forward the light limit, maybe, like in all these sci-fi movies that we have, like warp.
Yeah, that's kind of the concept of uh-huh. interstellar with this wormhole, which is a bypass to the speed of light limit. However, as I was saying before, one of the beauties of observing nearby stars, in particular Alpha Centauri, which is by far our closest star. Mm-hmm. So the next star that has similar condition is 3 times farther away. Mm-hmm. So Alpha Centauri presents this special opportunity to be within what I would say possible reach, because it's conceivable to be able to get there with a significant effort, and in, I don't know, 50, 100 years, that to be resolved. But as I was saying, it's not impossible. I don't think that trying to go beyond the speed of light is within the scope of our research or even possible. I'm a very applied engineer, so in general, I try to be focused on what I think that is physically possible. So that would be my answer for that question.
And what kind of new technologies with optics? I heard some years ago that they were talking about using new materials or using actually glasses, different type of glasses, actually data inside that it will move forward or it will make faster the way how computer works, but that, you know, using the technology of optics and light, how are you using, what is new there in the telescopes that can be used today to make these small and cheaper telescopes more viable, more to help us in mm-hmm. this mission?
So there are basically two main technologies that are being developed to address the question of exoplanets. Basically, the challenge that you have is that you have a very bright star, and then you need to observe a planet that is very dim. It's 10 billion times dimmer than the star, and it's very, very close. So the angular separation is less than an arc second. An arc second is taking a degree, normal degree, and divided by 3,600 times. So it's really a very, very small angle. Then what you need are optics that are able to suppress the light of the star without blinding the rest of the image. For example, when you point a digital camera to the sun, the whole camera gets white, or you have these white lines going down. That's called saturation. That means that there is light bleeding all over the system. Mm-hmm. So the optics that we need to develop are designed in such a way that you avoid that light bleeding and light contamination from the star. Now, there are two main strategies. One is called the Starshade, which is basically flying a second spacecraft that will make a shade, that will be a device that will block the light of the star, creating a shade for the telescope so you can see the planet. Mm-hmm. The challenge of that technology is that it requires a second spacecraft flying information, and that is very expensive. The second approach is to build what is called an internal coronagraph, so basically bring that little occulter that will cover the light, the starlight, inside the telescope. The problem of doing that is the precision and the tolerances are extremely high because you need to align very well the optics, and also the shape of the optic has to be extremely precise mm-hmm. to be able to focus all the starlight on this mask mm-hmm. that will block or cover the star. In that, that's the technology that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. And the main advance is special shape on the mirrors that allows you to funnel all the starlight into the mask and to avoid any contamination. The way that that mirror shape works is called phase-induced amplitude apolization, which is not easy to describe, but basically what it does is controls the way that light propagates on the telescope in such a way that we keep the light of the star completely packed and not contaminating any part of the image.
This is Atenea Americana, and I am your host, Isabel Jubes. You may find this and all my shows at StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org. This is a bilingual cultural show, bringing you a window to the Latin and Hispanic universe. Every week, for 2 hours, one in English and one in Spanish, from Stanford to the world. You can also be part of this, leaving me your comments, sharing your thoughts, and even more at StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org. I invite you to be part of this. And remember that today in Atenea Americana, we are talking with Chilean engineer Dr. Eduardo Pendek from NASA Ames in California.
So, what could be the main difference in what we can cut on camera or on a telescope between these new telescopes that are going to be around the Earth than between the other stuff that we have already cut, like in the Kepler or in Big Earth
observatories or in even the Hubble, because we have been listening already about all the star system that may have a possibility of new Earth-like planets, and that we can see far away, and we can deduce that we have this Earth-like planet somewhere. But this one in particular, what is the extra value?
So current telescope, ground-based and space like Hubble, they can see other planets, exoplanets. The problem is that they can see only giant planets that are far from the star. So planets that are the size of Jupiter or bigger, and those planets are possible to see with Hubble or ground-based telescope like Gemini South and the Sphere, which is an instrument at the VLT where I used to work. However, they're not able to get to small planets like the Earth. Because those planets are much smaller, and therefore they reflect less light from the star. And the star doesn't change on brightness. So you have a star, and depending the size of the planet is how bright it's going to look, because basically the planet is somehow reflecting the light from the star that's coming. If the planet is very small, it's very hard to see, and that's happened with planets like the Earth. If you go to bigger planets, they are not habitable because they are gas planets like Jupiter. So there is no possibility of developing normal life on those planets.
Is there, I suppose there is a big difference in the telescopes that you will make on Earth, not just because they have to look outside our atmosphere, like between the ones that you're making on Earth or outside, but also because of the gravity or the lack of oxygen, do they behave differently?
Yeah, one of the main difficulties is radiation, because in space you have a radiation that doesn't reach the surface of the Earth because the atmosphere protects us from that radiation. So all the electronics need to be specially designed. Also, the thermal gradients are very extreme because you, when the sun hits you, they hit you very, very without any protection. And on the other side, when you're exposed to just the space, it's very cold, so there are extreme temperature differences that are difficult to manage. So the benefit is that you don't have the atmosphere, so therefore you can observe the star without any perturbation. But the environmental conditions, the thermal and radiation, is a lot more aggressive. So it's necessary to invest money and design and subsystems on controlling that environment, on putting control systems that allow you thermal blankets that allow you to stabilize the temperature inside the instrument. So all those things are harder in space. Also, you cannot repair. You cannot go there and fix problems. So it has to be very robust and reliable. That's a trade that you sacrifice by going to space. You sacrifice cost, access, and environment complex.
When you build a house, when you live in a house here on Earth, just with the normal change of temperature during the year, you can listen, you can hear all the crackings of different woods, one of them expanding and contracting in different way, or the door doesn't open because the temperature, humidity, whatever changed already, and it's adjusting with a different one that the frame of the door has, and then it doesn't open because all the different materials have different expansion and contraction and times depending of the temperature. So I suppose that also with different materials in space that will happen and that will make things change and not fit very well. What kind of materials do you use in the things?
That's an excellent question, because the way that you describe the problem with this house is exactly what happened on space. So our approach to solve that problem, it's use and make the telescope and the mirrors of a very stable material. And we use the same material for the mirrors, for the optics, and for the structure. That allows you to make the telescope insensitive to thermal variation, because if the temperature changes, the whole system will change in shape, but at the same rate. Therefore, there will be no crack or differential expansion. So the cracks and the noises are due to differential expansion. That means that there are materials that expand faster than others, causing some friction between them. That is a big problem for us. So making the whole telescope out of the same material solves that problem, but also you want to have the system completely stable. So in addition to that, we use thermal shielding, that is materials that prevent the radiation and the thermal gradient to get in. And also we use active control. So we have heaters to maintain the whole telescope at the same temperature. So it's basically an oven with layers and layers of protection. That's the strategy that we approach to solve that problem.
And are you already moving forward with the first prototype? Do you already have dates of how long it's going to take to build the things and deadlines?
We submitted one of the proposals to NASA on December 18th. We are going to hear back if we get funding on July of this year. If all the fundings are approved, then we should be able to start construction on 2016 and be launching, no, 2017, end of 2016, and launch on 2020.
Wow.
So, and now in March, we're submitting the proposal for the small technology demonstrator that I was telling you, the one called Centaur. And we're submitting on March 20th, and we should hear in September if that gets approved. And then we'll start building as soon as possible, because that has to be developed quickly to be able to learn from that experience to feed into a larger mission.
Great. Great. Well, very exciting. And we hope to have you then soon to tell us how it went and what happened with the first prototype and everything.
Absolutely. I will be glad to come over again and tell you more about that.
Sure. Well, thank you for coming to Atenea Americana, and see you soon.
Thank you.
And this was Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
Stanford, 90.1 FM.
Radio
Atenea Americana.
A window to the Latin universe.
This is
Radio
Atenea Americana.
Bilingual house of culture, on the air and online.
Su casa de la cultura en la radio y online.
Para la radio 90.1 KCSU, Stanford.
I am Isabel Jubes.
Isabel Jubes. Vuelve pronto.
Atenea Americana.
From Stanford to the world.
Remember to come back soon.
Ciao.
See you later.